Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to Week, the Commonwealth Club's Political Roundtable. I'm John Zipperer, your week-to-week host, and I'm very glad you could all join us tonight. We're going to talk about some of the hot topics of the week, bring in your questions and comments, and we'll wrap it up by pairing two contestants for our week-to-week news quiz at the end of the program. Both contenders are going to receive a copy of California Cuisine and Just Food by Marion Nestle, and the winner will also walk away with this priceless bottle of, well, 2.5 buck chuck. And actually, Marion Nestle is going to be at the Commonwealth Club in October, so if you want to catch more Nestle, please join us then. This is a program that is chock full of opinions, so it's always good for me to note that, of course, any opinions expressed here by the panel, in our audience questions, they're only those of the speaker, not necessarily those of the Commonwealth Club, our members, guests, or supporters. A quick programming note, tomorrow night in this very same auditorium, we are hosting actress, singer, and author Rita Moreno. So she will be in conversation with KQED's Michael Krasny. So that's Tuesday at 6 p.m. Wow. Those tickets, by the way, are going very fast. So if you want to come, you want to get them right away. Excuse me a moment. And Week to Week itself, is heading to Silicon Valley for our September program. So we'll be in Palo Alto on Tuesday, September 10th. So please join us if you can. Now let's meet our panelists. I'm going to start on the end there with Robin Wilkie making her first appearance on our stage. She's the editor at Huffington Post San Francisco, which you can follow on Twitter at HuffPostSF. Next to her is C.W. Nevius. He's a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. He's on Twitter at C.W. Nevius. That was...
I probably could have thought of something more clever.
And between us is Melissa Griffin, a contributor to KPIX-TV and San Francisco Magazine. She's also an attorney. You can follow her on Twitter at MelissaCBSSF. I think we should just end on that. That's a good
high note. That was good.
It's good to be here.
There are question cards spread throughout the chairs. Please write down your questions, and we will answer as many as we can during our second half hour. I'll also try to work in some of them during our roundtable here in the first half. So let's get started with our first topic, and that is this giant sporting event that is making and breaking out on the bay, the America's Cup. Chuck, it looks like critics of the America's Cup have been proven wrong after all. Turns out it's not a boring race between tragedies and lawsuits and now accusations of cheating. It's quite exciting. So you've been covering this. Tell us, let's start with this cheating thing. What exactly is going
on? Well, a friend of mine who's very well connected said that he was not surprised that Larry Ellison was cheating. He was. He was surprised he got caught, because that's not a Larry Ellison thing. There's a long history of cheating in the America's Cup, frankly. It's a big part of the... In fact, Larry Ellison's Oracle team got caught cheating in New Zealand. They went down, hired a boat, they had some guys with binoculars, and they caught them. And they basically said, "What are you guys doing?" They said, "Cheating, you know, it's just kind of the America's Cup. What do you think we're doing?" But it did, Robin was just saying earlier, if you go down and watch those races, there is something compelling about them. Those boats are very, very exciting. I had a friend who had an app that you could watch the speed of the boats. And they were getting ready to go to the starting line, and he was reading the speed off. And it was 9 knots, 10 knots, and then they turned up wind, and he said 20 knots, 25 knots, 30 knots, 40. They accelerate like crazy. If they could just hold the event and not have any more scandals or problems, I think it might be a moderate success. But as it is, the cheating scandal is only the latest in a series of problems that's really undercut it. And as I said in my column, the cry in City Hall is, go New Zealand, because they've about had it with these guys.
Really? Melissa, you did a big story on this in the July San Francisco Magazine. And in fact, you were really going into what this means to the city, what it means to the mayor, and his plans for the waterfront and everything. What is at stake for San Francisco?
Well, in addition to the incredibly beautiful, sweeping pictures, I mean, I'm sitting in my apartment, like, eating Cheetos. Like, we live in the best city ever. Like, I just love watching it, the sweeping views. I mean, it's just great PR for the city. But also, I mean, there are huge plans for the waterfront, right? We mean, between Mission Bay and the Warriors Stadium. I mean, this is really supposed to kind of set the stage and almost be a practice run for people in the mayor's office who need to understand all of the different organizations and acronyms they need to work through to get permission to build and to have things at the waterfront. So I'm told by Jane Sullivan, who's in the mayor's office, that this is everyone's sort of viewing this as kind of a trial run, which isn't to say that there have actually been too many snafus on the mayor's part, but it is to say that in the future they're going to be able to understand how the processes work, because this whole area has been so underdeveloped for so long. And part of that was because for many years it didn't have its own source of revenue. And so anybody who wanted to build had to basically do everything. It had to be everything to everyone. It had to be a school, a library, a cafe, you know, a homeless shelter, and then whatever it was that developer wanted to do. So the demands on development were so huge because they didn't have any income. Well, now, I mean, the voters in San Francisco have voted a couple of bond measures. Now the peers actually have their own source of income, so they can partner with developers now. And that's why you're seeing such an explosion of development on the waterfront. And that's why so much is scheduled post-America's Cup to happen out there. So they're really looking to this. I have to say, I'm thoroughly enjoying this because it's like NASCAR. And look, and let's assume we want everyone to be safe, right? When nobody's happy about anybody getting injured or God forbid, hurt. But aside from that, I mean, every day in the last week, for example, between Luna Rossa and New Zealand, they've had really spectacular crashes. I mean, things are flying off the boats, like the sail falls, they got to toss it overboard. It's like, wow, that's cool, you know. So, I mean, I don't want to see, like, oh, look, two fast boats. I want to see, you know, things breaking. Frankly, I'm from Georgia. I don't know anything about this stuff. So I'm just like, as a regular person watching, like, I'm absolutely thrilled. So to that degree, some of this destruction and the intrigue has actually been the thing that's been interesting. It hasn't been the thing that's interrupted my enjoyment. It's actually been the source. Anyway, I digress.
Robin, are you looking for exciting crashes?
I do think that that's a kind of a part of the excitement, certainly. And it certainly makes for interesting media coverage, say that much. But I think Melissa makes a great point about saying that this is kind of a trial run for the city. And I think also, as Chuck mentioned, that there's kind of a long history of cheating in the America's Cup. And that is, you know, well documented. It's absolutely true. However, I think this new viewership in San Francisco isn't necessarily used to that. And so kind of learning the ins and outs of the America's Cup, I think that if they continue to do this going forward, I have a feeling it would be much smoother. I think it's just a matter of how much is it going to cost to get there, and is the public kind of going to, and the city, not to mention, you know, the city, are they going to be willing to see that through?
Now, is this something that would come back here if
Ellison wins, yeah, it would come back.
And now, and I have to interrupt you, that's part of the kind of weird thing about the America's Cup. The winner basically gets to determine what happens next, right?
It's my party, and I'll tell you what we're going to do. That's right. He picks the boat, he picks the venue, and he picks the conditions. So, but really, last summer, when we had the 42-foot boats, there were 12 entries. And that was exciting. We had fleet races. I mean, that was terrific. The idea of building these mega boats, these 72-foot boats with 110-foot wings, that's been a problem. They're incredibly expensive. They're incredibly dangerous, as we know. Mm-hmm. But there were crashes in the 42s, but it wasn't so serious. So I think that hurt things, and it would have been a great event if we'd had what we had in the last summer. And seriously, thousands of people showed up to watch those. So I think they just miscalculated that. They thought they weren't grand enough. They thought it wasn't a grand enough event, and they sold it to NBC as the spectacular, and I think they may have overpromised.
Well, and also the contract between the city and Oracle requires them to negotiate for a return to San Francisco if Oracle wins. Now, negotiating, a requirement to negotiate and a requirement to actually bring it here may not be the same thing. I mean, both parties might find that this was too much of a pain to bring it back here again. So it doesn't necessarily guarantee that it's going to come back. It just means that they definitely are contractually bound to talk if Oracle does end up winning. So we don't know. But by that time, who knows? We have, you know, Coney Island on the waterfront.
Raise your hands if you've been to watch any of the America's Cup races. it's mattering to folks. Now, talking about this as kind of a trial run, it's also kind of a trial run for we're getting the Super Bowl. And is it next year or the year after?
Year after.
That's right. Okay. And actually, there was talk that this was a bit of a trial run for the Olympic Games. And in a very weird way, it is a great trial run for the Olympic Games because it's an enormous pain to put on the Olympic Games. And it's very difficult. There's a lot of moving parts. I've been to 8 of them. And every single time until the actual first race starts, it's chaos. And this is also a little bit chaotic. It just makes you realize that you're talking about other countries, other cultures, other interests. I mean, there's several reporters from New Zealand here right now that are covering this like it was the Super Bowl because sailing is the national sport in New Zealand. It's a big deal to them. So you just get the idea that we sometimes with the Super Bowl think we're the only little country in the world. We're not, and there's a lot of moving parts. So just remember this when somebody says it'd be a good idea for us to host the Olympics.
Well, we all remember when Mitt Romney made that great trip to the UK and just before their Olympics started basically intimated that they had done less than a smash-up job on the games, which they, in fact, did turn out to be a very successful game. But aren't Olympic Games kind of like what people here are fearing, which is that the host city actually usually loses money on them?
Yeah, and I remember, just as an example, the Atlanta Games. And they did a bang-up job. They went all out. Frankly, the media may be a little bit of a complainer group, but we were on a bus in Atlanta, and people were complaining about the buses and the accommodations and the food. And finally, one of the Atlanta reporters got up and said, you know what, that's enough. We're doing as best we can. And it's hard not to be that person because it's your city. It's your area. You're represented. But everybody's got an opinion. I remember being on a bus into the Los Angeles Games, and we drove by a guy on the sidewalk who'd been shot. And I was like, what? And the guy in front of me, who was, I don't know what country he was from, but he turned to the guy next to him and said, oh, yeah, that happens here all the time.
Well, I'm from a suburb of Atlanta, and I was living there at the time that the 96 Olympics came, and everyone just wanted to get out of town. It was actually a hugely miserable experience. And they built a number of structures that then later were turned into dorms, for example, for like Georgia Tech students and Georgia State students, and they were crazy. You would go there, they would just like a Potemkin village. You'd go there and like you'd open a cabinet and like the door would fall off. And you're like, what the hell is it? Like they put them together so quickly, they were horrible quality. And to your point, not a lot of people had a good time. I'm not sure that that the Olympics is something we should hope for as a city. Having said that, I remember a couple of years ago it was the World Cup, that's the soccer one, right?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry for the sisterhood for doing that.
the sisterhood.
I know. I'm a girl. But the World Cup, they were narrowing down, so there's like an American committee that determines what cities we're going to put forth as a country to try and pitch the World Cup. And so the committee that decides which American cities had narrowed it down to like 16 cities, and we did not make the cut to like the 16 cities. And I remember Ross Mercurimi being at the Board of Supervisors going nuts because he's like, Tampa? We got beat by Tampa? Like, Tampa was on the list. Nashville was on the list. Everyone was so offended that we didn't even make the top 16. So, I mean, we may not want the Olympics, but it would be nice to host something like a World Cup. There are other events I think that would be fun, like the Super Bowl, that I think we're going to be able to enjoy maybe a little short of like the full Olympic treatment.
Well, one last question on the America's Cup issue, and start with you, Robin. How do you think San Francisco has come off to the New Zealanders and other people visiting us?
That's a good question, and I think that there's probably no way that they haven't picked up on some of the kind of public malaise about the event, and even just the attendance has probably not gone unnoticed. However, I mean, I do think the setting alone is a pretty spectacular one, and what they've been able to do just to put Melissa's fiance was writing about this today, about what they've been able to construct and then take down and then put up once again, you know, the next morning. It's pretty phenomenal, I think, all the stops that have gone out. Granted, I haven't gone to see it in New Zealand, but I hope that maybe they see it as great potential.
Yeah. Chuck, how do you think we did?
Well, two things. One is we've got Larry Ellison taking a lot of the heat for us. I think a lot of people are saying, well, it's not San Francisco's fault. Larry's not doing a very good job of staging this thing. I also think that we're a great city of front runners, and once we see something that really does seem to be exciting, I could see people turning out for it. Last Saturday night, we went to see Steely Dan. My wife and I went to see Steely Dan. And if one more person asks, how is he doing? I realized I was probably a little old. But that was a great event. That was a great event. And that pavilion is terrific, 9,000 seats. It's great seating. I actually was talking to some people in North Beach. They don't seem like it stops at 10:30. I said the other day, maybe we should leave that up and just host summer concerts. And somewhere in North Beach, Aaron Peskin grabbed his heart and fell over. But I do think there are some good things to come out of this. And it gives you an idea of what it is to stage a major event.
Melissa?
Well, I think that the Bay has been a perfect place. I mean, the sailing has been as close to the shore as it's ever been in the history of the sport. The winds and the treachery, again, I'm the crash lover. The winds have just made it really incredibly treacherous and interesting. And so I think that the Bay is very naturally a great place to hold it, and I think that they really appreciate that. Although the one quote was that, you know, what Jimmy Spithill, the skipper of the Oracle boat, said, you know, it's a beautiful city. It's a beautiful bay. And then, good Lord, what have you done to your waterfront? You know, it's dilapidated. The piers are, you know, they're horrible. And he goes, well, you know, you have this beautiful city, this beautiful skyline, and yet you've let this whole area right here just go to hell. So he was a little taken aback at sort of how we had not done more with the area. But that was the main sort of takeaway that I was able to get from talking to them.
I wonder if he's aware that we used to have this beautiful highway double-decker.
That
was the best thing.
Freeway.
Well, we've got some questions from you folks on the America's Cup, so we'll come back to this during the Q&A time. But I wanted to move on to our next topic, and that is the U.S. Attorney General, Eric Holder, basically is, what's the way to phrase it? He's going AWOL on the war on drugs, I believe, some people have said. He's calling for a dialing down of some of the very aggressive approach toward the war on drugs. For those of us who remember back in the 1980s, really, this started up with, we've got to really get tough on this, and we have. And there's been a lot of criticism mounting as our prisons have gotten fuller, and we've built more prisons than those have gotten fuller. Been a lot of criticism over, are we putting away people who should be out on the street and living their lives? And then there are issues of differential sentencing that different types of drugs get, possibly race-based. So with all of those issues, Eric Holder came out and basically said, let's look at a different way of doing this. And my question for the panel is there much he can do? Is this something Congress needs to take on? Robin, do you want to?
Yeah, I think, and I think that is maybe one thing that that people forget is that he's essentially done is provided a guidepost to say, you know, here's the direction we would like to go. And he can certainly say, you know, we're not going to prosecute certain cases. But what it sounds like is that when he's really talking about those low-level offenders, those aren't necessarily cases that they would be taking on anyway. And so I think that what would be the next step would be, as you mentioned, Congress, would be to change legislation. And so I think that what he can do is say this is our recommendation, and then that statement has gotten quite a bit of support across the board, and so hopefully that will urge lawmakers to kind of move forward on some of those recommendations.
Chuck?
Well, I think that's a great point, and he's raising the issue, which is the issue of unintended consequences. It sounds great to get tough on drugs, but arresting someone and putting them in a prison, I was saying, I said I'd been to San Quentin. Melissa said, I didn't realize you had a record. It wasn't. That was not it. I was there for a story. But the conditions there are unbelievable. The size of the cells and the idea that there are three men living in those cells is unbelievable. And what Holder said about warehousing people rather than treating people. I mean, I don't know that we want to let them out on the street and just say you're done. But his point is counseling. We've been dealing with addiction for how many years? Hundreds of years. And this is not helping. This idea of locking people up is not helping. It's crowding the prisons. There's probably a certain number of people that need to be in prison. And these low level guys, I think, can be treated in a different way. So that he's raising the discussion, which is a great thing. it'll be interesting to see where it goes, because I still think it's very appealing to people. These are some of the same people who say, secure the border, get tough on drugs. It's a very appealing idea to say, we're going to lock them up. And it hasn't worked. And now where do you go? And we better have a pretty good answer to that.
I think to Robin's point, which was totally correct, that when you're talking about felonies, I mean, Eric Holder's he's limited in what he's going to be able to do here. Mm-hmm. Felonies are either things that are crossing state lines or crimes that are very severe. So by nature, he's not the one who's going to be making those decisions on misdemeanors and on smaller issues of possession. That is federal legislation, and that is state legislation. And most of the laws say if you're convicted of X, then Y. Well, the issue then becomes a DA or somebody like in a Holder's position can help give some guidance about what we're going to charge. But ultimately, it's going to take legal change to eliminate that, X equals Y equation. Because as long as that's out there, you're going to continue to have these. So, I mean, I think it's a good thing. I think it's important to have the conversation. But let's not mistake his statement of policy for an actual change that's going to result in any massive release of prisoners or decrease in the number of drug offenders going to jail.
I would again say the idea when we passed this was this is going to be so punitive that these people will stop selling drugs. Mm-hmm. Well, they're in a terrible, terrible situation. My wife works in a law firm. One of the attorneys had us over the other night, and she worked with some of the some at-risk girls in Oakland. And she was talking about gunfire every night. She was talking about the number of people she knew that died. And this attorney said to her, wouldn't you like to live in a neighborhood where that didn't happen? Wouldn't you like to move to a neighborhood where that didn't happen? And she said, I think it's the same everywhere. I mean, her concept was that was America, that's all they had. So the idea that you might go to jail, yeah, I know, but I also might be able to make some money. So that's not going to stop drug dealing. And I think that's kind of what he was trying to say.
And I think you'd mentioned kind of the rehabilitation approach. And I think listening to Holder's kind of new platform of being smart on crime, mm-hmm. and anybody who spent some time in San Francisco politics might think that sounds familiar. And seeing what Kamala Harris did with her programs of trying to push back on recidivism and focus on rehabilitation instead of punishment was largely successful. And so I think it's encouraging, at least even if it is just kind of talking about it, it's encouraging to see them moving in that direction.
Plus, it's more fodder for speculation that she might be the next attorney general.
On that note, let me ask again for a show of hands, how many people took BART on their way to here tonight? Quite a few. You can guess where I'm going with this for our next topic, right? So Governor Jerry Brown answered a lot of people's prayers, maybe yours, when he first called, he stalled that strike that was about to happen at the beginning of this month, and then after it was stalled for about 7 days, just before that time frame was up, he got convinced the judge to grant a 60-day cooling-off period. So for the moment, at least, Bay Area commuters can ride to work and play in the Commonwealth Club without fearing a strike. My question for you folks, and maybe start with Melissa, is the governor basically taking a side here by taking away what is the union's one? I mean, that's their pressure that they can apply.
To some degree, right? I mean, the idea of a strike, I mean, the whole point of a strike is to give unions a tool in negotiations. But remember, the governor can only do this one time. He gets one 60-day reprieve. Case law is very clear. You get one. You don't get another one. So at the end of this, just like in 1997, there could be an additional strike at the end of... So 97, Pete Wilson calls for the 60-day reprieve period, and then there's still a 5-day strike on the other end of it. So, I mean, it could still... There could still be a strike, and there would be really kind of nothing that he could do. The only thing that would be left, aside from an actual negotiated contract, would be for the legislature to pass a law that basically says public transit employees are not allowed to strike.
Which many cities do have that rule?
Oh, yeah, we do. San Francisco has that rule. I mean, hey.
So for Muni, they can't strike.
They can't strike. And across the state, police and fire can't strike because that is a de facto public health and safety risk. And in San Francisco, it's in our charter, our city employees can't strike. There are only a few places where public transit employees are allowed to strike. In the absence of a law that prohibits it, you have to do this thing. We have to declare a public safety crisis, and that's the one legal way you can sort of get this little reprieve. So back in 1997, Quentin Kopp, who was then a state senator, said, I'm going to go pass a law saying transit employees aren't allowed to strike anymore, and it went nowhere. And then in 2001, Don Parada said he was going to do the same thing after we narrowly missed two strikes in 2001. So it's been a legislative non-starter, I think, to some degree, because, I mean, we're talking about SEIU employees who are very powerful and give a lot of money to legislators, and so I think their interests are pretty well protected in that regard. So I think we're going to see at the end of the 60 days, to me, if I'm the SEIU, I don't have a whole lot of incentive to do anything. I mean, I'm right back where I started at the end, and if no one will pass a law prohibiting me from doing this, what's my downside? So I think Jerry Brown understands that and was kind of playing to, you know, doing something that I think is very popular among a lot of voters, but ultimately doesn't actually specifically get to a point of resolution on this whole thing. I mean, that would take that kind of legislation. And don't get me wrong, Marc Desaulniers in Concord is now saying that he's going to propose that. Again, then it does have to pass.
He's the sacrificial lamb for this round.
Yes, I know. He's the next, you know. So, I mean, we'll see what happens. But he called it, and it does look like he's trying to take a stand. But again, ultimately, I'm not sure that it gets us much further down the road.
Chuck?
I never disagree with Melissa, but in this case, I think Governor Brown actually answered the workers' prayers, too. They have so misplayed this to the point where they have overplayed their hand. And I think the original idea was they had a concept, which was, we'll throw out this pay raise way up here, and then little by little we'll come down. But the minute those numbers got out, and we heard that their medical plan is $92, that they pay nothing for their pension, that we started comparing these numbers and the overtime to other people in an economy where people are out of work, where people of 30s and 40s are out of work for a long time, that was never going to be a good strategy. It was never going to play well. And I think if you're going to have a successful strike, you've got to have two things. One of two things. You have to either have public support, which I don't think they have, or you have to have such a hammer and it's so inconvenient that people cannot function without it. And I think we proved that they could. Now, they picked an odd time for the strike, but there's home commuting. There are other ways to get around. I think people, they didn't like it. Nobody liked it. But I think they found a way to get around it. And I think the SEIU is a little bit locked in the politics of the past, and it's going to come back to bite them. A much better idea would be to be the bigger group. I think there's a raise on the table. Take some of that and realize that, I don't know about you, but my medical benefits are costing more. People I know's medical benefits are costing more. You're going to have to pay more for those kinds of things too. It's just the way of the world. So I think they may have a moment here to cool off, to step back and realize, you know, while they're charging the hill, there's nobody behind them.
Yeah, I think I'm going to agree with Chuck on that one, actually. And I think that the raise that's on the table now is, I know it's not originally what they asked for, but it is, by a lot of standards, pretty reasonable. And I think that when the public opinion turned was really a turning point in that strike. The same people who were saying no workers absolutely must have the right to strike, you know, oh yeah, but did you hear what they're making? You know, it took an ugly turn in a day. It was, you know, in the morning everyone supporting, and then in the commute home everybody was against it. So.
In fact, Robin, you called this the Bartpocalypse. And I don't know about you guys. I actually kind of enjoyed working at home with my cat sleeping on my keyboard. And it wasn't that bad. I could get used to that. But you also have written on Huffington Post about all of these different ways that have allowed people to get through this more. There obviously are folks who also have to go to work or they don't get paid. But do you think that in itself, also the fact that there are fewer people who are seriously impacted by it also cuts into support for the union?
I do, and I think it's it became interesting when there was talk about an AC Transit strike is when I think people started to go, whoa. And then actually we just earlier you guys were mentioning what a catastrophe it would have been if the strike had been going on when the Bay Bridge closed for Labor Day. Unfortunately, now obviously that won't happen. But I think that when people start to think about those other alternatives being taken away, that's when it starts to get a bit more desperate.
And not to pile on, but the tone deafness of the arguments has really been remarkable. I just think they could use a much better PR firm. They have a case to make, and I don't think they're making it very well. And whenever they would say something, and then management would come back with, you realize they don't even drive the trains. I mean, it was like, they just seemed to have so much more ammunition, and they kept walking into it. It just seemed like that was the problem. I mean, at the Chronicle, we just went through a labor negotiation, and it was not easy, and there, tempers flared, and we went through all those kinds of things. But there's a way to do it, and again, I think they're a little caught in the politics of the past, and that's hurting them.
So any predictions on what happens in 60 days? Are they going to cool off during this cooling off period? Are they going to heat up?
I have a prediction from someone who's not me, but who seems to know what's going on, and his prediction is we take it to the last minute, then we stop the clock in the famous labor negotiation maneuver, and then they settle.
Robin, prediction?
I think that's probably a safe prediction. I don't see another strike being very popular, but I certainly see it as possible.
Melissa?
I tend to agree, maybe a short strike. But ideally, they'll bring in a third party, not a politician, because they've historically kind of mucked things up, but maybe some other neutral third party, because both sides need to really save face in the situation. I mean, they've really gotten their troops fired up and made a lot of promises, and in order to, I think, make sure everybody can get out of this with any kind of credibility, maybe a third party would come in and negotiate a settlement either right before the 60 days is up or maybe a little bit after.
Well, we'll see how last minute it is. I remember in Illinois when they were having their state legislature vote on, I think it was a stadium bill, and they had to have it done by midnight on a certain day. And as they tend to do in legislatures, they got talking and talking, went past midnight, so they solved it by having someone get up and literally turn the clock back. So they're creative in Illinois government. Let's move on to our next topic, though instead of slow lumbering trains from the 1970s, let's talk about high-speed rail. There recently, I can tell from the groans in the audience, this is your favorite topic. Well, a judge might be agreeing with you. Melissa, bring us up to date with what happened on Friday, right?
Right. So you guys might remember back in 2008 when we passed Prop 1A, the high-speed rail proposition, that was to allow $10 billion in general obligation bonds to be issued. So the idea was we can issue $10 billion in obligation bonds, but all the other money is going to come from federal and private sources. Right? Okay. So fast forward to when they're going to begin construction on a section of rail. All right, so one of the things that the law requires is that the rail has to be built. It doesn't have to be built all at once, but it has to be built in usable chunks, right? So God forbid something happens, so you can go from L.A. to Bakersfield. That's not nothing, right? So it has to be done.
It's kind of a step down.
It's something. It's not from nowhere to nowhere, right? It's a thing. So it has to be built in usable chunks, and that is to prevent this issue of sort of half a rail or half a bridge, right? And so what the High-Speed Rail Authority did is they came up with this thing that is less than a usable chunk. It's really a nowhere to nowhere, and they admit like there is no use for this thing, but they have funding for it, and they go, oh, we have funding for this little chunk that is useless, and the judge was like, that has nothing to do with anything. You're supposed to be building in usable chunks. But they said, and the other thing, again, to back up, is that you have to be building in usable chunks, and every time you build a big usable chunk, you have to identify all the funding for it. Because, again, you can't build half a highway, right? You can't just put your shovels in and then expect us to bail you out. Every time you build a chunk, you got to identify the big old pot of money you're going to take for it. So in this case, they said, oh, well, we have all the money for this really useless little piece. And the judge said, no, two things. Number one, you got to build in a usable chunk. Number two, when you do that, you have to be able to identify all the funding for it. Well, they couldn't identify all the funding for it because either chunk that they're proposing is about $22 to $24 billion. And all they have is $3 billion from the federal government and $2.7 billion from that initial $10 billion pot of money that we had agreed to. And so the judge said, you have no reasonable expectation. He said, and I quote, it is absolutely clear that there is no reasonable expectation of any other money coming in, either from the federal government or from private sources, for either of these chunks. So it's really important ruling, I think. And right now what we're waiting for is for the judge to figure out how to remedy this, because the legislature, in all its eminent wisdom, has already authorized the bonds of $2.7 billion in bonds to build a useless piece of track. So he's trying to figure out what's the remedy in this case, and that's something that they're going to be briefing and we're going to be hearing about in the next couple of weeks. But it reminds me, I digress, but there's this scene in All the King's Men, the Sean Penn movie, where he plays a corrupt Louisiana governor. And
so a Louisiana governor.
Yeah. So a governor. And he's sitting and he says, I want money to build a highway. And his legislative aide says, well, the legislature's not going to give you the money you want. They're going to give you half the money you want. And he says, well, then we will build half a highway. We're going to build a mile of concrete, a mile of dirt, a mile of concrete, a mile of dirt. And the other legislative aide goes, no one will stand for that. And he says, exactly. Yeah, and that is the point, is that if you just get started, then we're all on the hook for the rest of it. And it seems that they know that, and that is why there's this attempt to kind of weasel into this little mini nowhere to nowhere bit of track, because once it's built, we all are kind of on the hook to build the rest of it, even though we haven't identified federal or private funding. So that's what the judge ruled, and that's what we're kind of waiting. Again, we're waiting on the remedy for it. But I think it's got a real potential to do to. The whole thing just lends itself to so many puns. To derail the project. Sorry, I know. To derail the project. And if that happens, then they're going to appeal it. But let's say just for now, the whole thing is sort of on hold.
Chuck, are you buying your ticket for the
Hyperloop? I am, yeah.
For the Hyperloop?
So you're saying it's kind of the America's Cup of trains is what you're kind of saying.
I'm saying it's the Bay Bridge of trains.
Well, it's funny because you mentioned that, but Willie Brown actually wrote that the other day in his column, which was when you do these projects, you throw out a number and say we're going to be able to do it for this amount, and then you dig a hole. And once they have the hole, then we got to do something with it. And that's exactly what they were trying to do. I mean, we'd love to have high-speed rail. That would be a great thing, but it's going to be incredibly expensive, and they're going to have to bite the bullet on the fact that it's going to be that expensive. Money is not forthcoming. We're seeing this happen. I mean, we're about to see it in North Beach, where they try to extend the Central Subway up to the I don't know if you know it, but today the Pagoda Theater walls are coming down. It's only been 20 years, you know, rocket-like time for San Francisco, but that's another example of a project where they're going to build, they're going to put the hole in the ground, and they're going to hope money comes. And that's kind of the American way. You drill a hole and hope money shows up. So that's what we're doing.
Robin?
Yeah, I think, today Brown was saying until that remedy is issued that they're going to continue building, they're going to continue going for construction projects, they're going to continue going forward. And upon reading that, initially thinking, wow, that's pretty reckless. You know, they're going to sign these contracts and allocate these funds that might not be there.
Yeah.
But I think you're absolutely right that they might see now as a better time than ever to get this construction project started as soon as possible, so that we might not have a choice in where we go forward from there.
That's how my wife remodeled our kitchen. I know.
One of our audience members asks, what is the attraction of a 40-year-old technology? I rode the Japanese bullet trains in the 1960s. If you like fast trains, and who doesn't, we're pretty far behind. I thought it was interesting the United Kingdom is having a huge dispute right now. Some of you may know their train service is not particularly good. I think the English word for it is bad. So they're considering building this. They're trying to build this. this high-speed rail network. The cost there make ours look like loose change. It's anywhere from $65 to $100 billion.
The Hyperloop, $6 billion. I just want to say bargain.
Thanks for taking my news quiz question.
Oh, sorry.
Ooh,
what I get this. Said. You have no idea what she just said.
Did you see the Onion story where it said the Hyperloop was going to be powered by the screams of terrified passengers?
Assuming this train to nowhere ever gets built, is it going to change anything besides get some people faster between the cities, or is this an economic engine of some sort? I mean, any
How much does it cost? Does it cost less than us to fly or not? I mean, I think that's the bottom line. If we can, it's a wonderful way to travel. I'm sure that'll be great. But at the end of the day, if you can fly Southwest for whatever it is, $125 to Los Angeles, is that going to be cheaper than to take how many hours is it to go to Los Angeles from San Francisco once this is built?
That's it. 2.5.
Yeah, 2.5.
That was in the voter guide. That's what it's supposed to be.
2.5.
Who knows?
So
guide wouldn't lie.
Yeah,
what?
So if it makes economic sense, sure. But if it doesn't, it's a bit of a vanity project.
I was at an event one time, and there was Fiona Ma, who was very big on High Speed Rail, got up and she spoke. And it was this huge, it was like the Hyatt Ballroom, and all the tables were clapping, and she was talking about High Speed Rail, and yeah. And there was one table, and nobody was clapping, and I looked, and it was Southwest Airlines. They were like, the estimates, though, have grown exponentially. I mean, from what was initially promised in the voter guide, it's supposed to be 2.5 hours. It's supposed to be around $100. Now it's estimated at something like $250, and that's from the November 2011 estimates. So, I mean, it keeps going up and up and up, and frankly, if it was a good business proposition, then money would be materializing from private investors who would think that they could actually get a return on this. But part of the problem is it is looking less and less like a moneymaker and more and more like, an Amtrak, which has, been a money loser for many years.
Something that will require subsidy to keep going.
Exactly, and operating costs keep going up and up. Every time they do a new estimate, those costs go up by, a couple bill here and there.
That can add up.
Yeah, I know, real money after a while.
Robin, last thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think comparing it earlier to the Bay Bridge, people are going to use the Bay Bridge regardless, and they can hike the tolls if need be, but people are not going to necessarily use the high-speed rail if there are other options.
Mm-hmm. That actually is a great segue to just patting on the back Chuck and Melissa, who the last time they were here made predictions of when the Bay Bridge would open. Cars may not survive getting all the way across it, but it is going to open on Labor Day weekend. So congratulations. You heard it here first.
Sadly right.
Blind squirrels, acorns, it's the whole...
Well, speaking of which, to those of you who are following us on audio, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club's week-to-week political roundtable. Our panel this week includes Melissa Griffin, C.W. Nevius, and Robin Wilkie, and I'm your host, John Zipper. Let's dig into some more of these questions. If BART comes to an agreement, won't we, the commuters, end up paying the bill? They have us in a half Nelson.
I think it's a full Nelson. yes, I mean, it's absolutely true. I mean, they keep saying, oh, well, BART has this money sitting around. It's like, hey, there's no BART. BART is not a thing. Like, it's us. And the money that they have is supposed to be for infrastructure projects. And it's difficult because management has given themselves such extraordinary salaries. They don't exactly have a whole lot of credibility. But yeah, at the end of the day, I mean, it's all the fares go up and up and up every year. And, yeah, of course, yeah, it ends up being us.
Yeah, and Robin is right. I mean, that's a utility that people have to use. They want to use. I used to park in BART when the parking was free. Then it became a dollar. Then, it has gone steadily up. It will continue to go steadily up, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a number of questions on San Francisco's favorite topic. Your answers on drugs treat the problem after the person has transgressed. Why not have a campaign to make people happier with their real lives before drugs, so that they don't need chemicals to achieve happiness? Robin, could you get on that?
Sure thing. I mean, I think when we're talking about drugs, I think we're kind of looking at a little bit of a different issue. I think the main drugs that Holder is addressing are not necessarily going to be ecstasy or kind of party drugs. He's looking at more. I think marijuana is probably largely included in there. And I think a lot of marijuana policy reform advocates were a little bit disappointed that he didn't go further to address that. I think when he went to go speak in front of the ABA, it was kind of like, oh, he's going to announce how they're going to handle Colorado, how they're going to handle Washington, and did not. And so I think maybe that was a little bit hopeful to think that he was going to go there. But I think that where this will have the most impact is probably for larger kind of drug scale operations, marijuana, cooking, things like that.
On the way over here, a couple in front of me was smoking a joint, walking down the street. I mean, people who say marijuana is essentially legal in San Francisco, and I wonder if he's not going to just let that play out however it's going to play out. Colorado's mm-hmm. going to do whatever it's going to do. San Francisco's going to do what. That's something probably he's. You can only lose getting mm-hmm. in that argument. But hard drugs, heroin, I mean, some of those things, I think there's something to be said for that. And maybe that's what he's hoping to concentrate on.
Mm-hmm. To the question, though, just real quick. I don't know if you guys remember this. There was the DARE program. So there's Just Say No, and then there was, like, the DARE program. And subsequent studies showed that students that were exposed to that were actually more likely to try drugs. So I'm not sure if the, you know, get out there and prevent drug use and help get mm-hmm. people get happy. I'm not sure we can trust the folks in charge to come up with a plan that would actually do that.
And I think maybe it's not necessarily looking at how we'd like things to be, mm-hmm. but more looking at how they are. And I think that maybe Holder's speech was kind of addressing how things have been for quite a few years yeah. and how they're probably not going anywhere.
Well, I think someone kind of pulls a lot of that together and says, do you think drugs should be a public health issue rather than criminal issue? That certainly seems to be where quite a bit of public opinion in a number of states is moving.
Yeah, I think they are. It's just that we have not found a good or effective way to treat them. And you can see it every day in the streets of San Francisco. It's a very difficult. And there's many, many very well-intentioned, very well-trained people who are working on it, and it's I don't see that we're making a tremendous amount of progress. It's a really difficult and sad situation.
Well, one of those topics that gets San Franciscans really worked up, and I've got a couple different questions here on it, so I'm going to bring it up. But we were talking about the waterfront, redevelopment, the nightmare of redeveloping in San Francisco, and this is the 8 Washington Project.
Ooh.
And someone wrote in saying, must these measures like the 8 Washington Project really be put on a ballot? I mean, do we have to go through that deep of a process? Is that because the voters just do not trust the developers in the city? I mean,
no, it's because certain people are not happy with how the Board of Supervisors voted on something. And so, look, there is a provision in the charter that says if you are not happy with a vote from the Board of Supervisors within, I think, 30 or 60 days, you ask them, you gather enough signatures, and they have to revote. And if they revote the same way they voted before, then you get to go to the ballot. I mean, this is something that's been, like, this is from 1928 or whatever. So, I mean, God forbid, right? Because nobody wants to be designing our skyline by referendum. It's, you know, it's already bad enough that we have to vote on, like, circumcision and, you know, stuff like that on our ballot. It's terrible. But I don't think that, you know, this is a really dangerous precedent. And then one side does it. And then the developers have to put their anti, you know. So now we've got clean, safe development versus clean, safe development. Like, what the hell does that mean? You know, they get into these, like, you know, crazy titles that mean nothing and end up on the ballot. I think that it's people are right to be resentful of having to deal with that and having it put to us when they either can't trust or don't want to deal with our elected supervisors.
As you know, I never disagree with Melissa, but in this case, the only concern I have, and 8 Washington is a great example, and dare I say it, the Warriors Arena is another example, is that we have these absolutely rock-hard community groups. I am getting something on the Warriors Arena every single day in my email box, every day. Why it's a bad idea, we've got to stop this thing. I don't know who he represents. I mean, I know he represents a small group of people that are interested.
Who's he?
Lawrence, mm-hmm. Lawrence Stokes. Yes. You don't get those?
Yeah, I just feel like the audience.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, no, it's maybe he's here. But I don't know how much support he has. I'm not clear on how many people are opposed to 8 Washington. I'm not clear on how many people are in favor of 8 Washington. And I know that they've done polls that say if you put the Warriors Arena up to a vote in the city of San Francisco, it would win by 68%. 68% would favor it. So I'm not sure how the, and we all know that the Board of Supervisors end up with a lot of very angry people yelling in the chamber, and then there's a vote, and sometimes I'm not clear on who's representing whom. And so I'm not, in these cases, particularly something as volatile as 8 Washington or the Warriors Arena, I'm not sure we shouldn't vote on it because I'm not smart enough to figure out who's just a very loud voice and who is really speaking for a neighborhood and speaking for a city.
Robin?
Right, yeah. I mean, and the gentleman that you were referring to earlier, anything that I have heard about him is more that it's it would personally be affecting him
yes.
because of where he lives.
Yes.
And so, which I think is certainly a motivation for anybody who is against projects like
yeah.
that, certainly. But I do think, especially when it comes to things like 8 Washington or I think that a lot of people have been jaded by projects in the past, and kind of seeing how those have gone forward. But I think one thing that's important to remember is how things, I mean, looking back, for instance, at the America's Cup, and granted that never had an enormous public support, but that there was so much excitement over big new things, or excitement over a Super Bowl or an Olympics or something like that, over a big, you know, shiny new building, I don't necessarily think that people aren't going to support it even if it isn't a great idea.
And to your point, I mean, this gentleman is personally affected. I don't want to have to vote every time somebody wants to, you know, add a bathroom to their apartment. it's not appropriate, I think, for the mechanism. It's too important.
Okay. Well, one person wrote in to say we shouldn't be talking about the America's Cup because it's such a trivial thing. Another person, however, did ask a question that I just want to clarify.
Jimmy Spithill, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, he doesn't want to talk about it. And this is just someone saying we're talking about Ellison's team being caught cheating. What exactly were they caught doing? Could we clarify that?
In fairness, they put illegal weights on the 42-foot boats that raced. Now, several people have written in to me and said, you realize it was not the America's Cup 72-foot boats. But frankly, if the team is cheating, the team is cheating, in my point of view. And I don't see it's that much difference than Alex Rodriguez. They used illegal substances to get an advantage. They put 5 to 7 pound weights in the front of the bows of the boats. And there's a very strict measurement code. In fact, there's a measurement jury that goes over each boat with absolutely a fine-tooth comb. And the idea, this is why Ellison is mad, the idea that they would hand over these boats with the incriminating evidence sitting in the bow was kind of incredible. So I think the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing, but at the end of the day, both of those hands were cheating. So...
Thank you. Well, this is a topic we did not discuss, but as I'm nothing if not a slave to popular opinion. So we've got a couple questions, and this is referring to all the NSA surveillance and our friend Edward Snowden, who's vacationing in Russia right now. One question is, why does Obama, a Democrat, go against Snowden, who revealed how the NSA is watching our every moves through emails, et cetera? Where's the ACLU? And the president actually did come out recently. I don't know if you folks saw his press conference. He announced some changes in that he wants to do to try to make a little bit more transparent at least the way the surveillance system is operating. But any thoughts on that whole scandal, controversy?
Well, they all go 180 degrees. I don't know, did you see Larry Ellison on CBS? I mean, one of the things he said was,
that's right,
first of all, that information is being mined all the time by groups like Yahoo, for example, or Google. And second of all, where is the evidence that something bad has happened from that information? And there is some evidence, I think, that it has actually stopped some terrorist attacks. I feel like I should be more outraged than I am, but I'm really not. I don't know that it has been misused. I think it's worth knowing that this is going on, but at the end of the day, it is a dangerous world, and it seems like this has been used pretty judiciously. I'll now cover up.
No, I never disagreed. I just think as a Democrat, you're always careful about appearing soft on crime. I think part of what happened in the 80s actually was both the Democrats trying to get relevance, and so they're like, yeah, we're tough on crime too. And so there was this, so both groups were like, yeah, let's sentence them to life. And this is somewhat similar in that, you know, you don't want to appear to be soft on terrorism or national security, especially if you're a Democratic president, and especially if it's happening under your watch. You know, you can't be like, oh yeah, that thing, is that what we're doing? I didn't know that that's what we were doing. That's bad, that thing that's happening for the last 6 years that I've been in office. I think he had a responsibility to CYA, and also, again, as a liberal, as a Democrat, I think he's under a lot of pressure to not look like he's being soft, because God forbid, he's still got a few more years, and if something bad happens during his administration, I mean, it is, you know, it's something that his party and even his legacy is going to be sort of stuck with for the rest of history. So I think he's being careful.
That's some of what we've seen on the drug war too, don't you think? The Democrats latching onto that and saying, we're just as tough. Bill Maher expected Obama to become a little looser on drugs, having written publicly about his own youthful exuberance or whatever, experimentation. And of course, he hasn't. I think it does go to the, you know, no, it's like when you're playing tug of war with your puppy and the puppy's going, and you're sounding, it's like, yeah, you're so cute, you're tough. That's
how's
so
that?
Neat.
How's that again?
I'm not redoing that. Let's just go congressional. Please speak to the congressional and general political resistance to repealing mandatory minimum sentencing for federal crimes. Do you think that's declining? Do you think that's going to follow older stuff?
Yeah, I hope that it will. And I think that, again, you know, just what we were just talking about before about having to appear one way.
Yeah.
And then just not to backtrack, but to note about that, I do think that some people have been, I agree with Melissa about what Obama's probably trying to do. But it is a little bit frustrating since that was during his first term, people would say, well, he can't because he wants to get reelected. And then during the second term, he'll be able to do all these other things. And then, you know, oh, no, he has to protect his legacy. So I can see how there is
the legacy.
Could certainly be some frustration about that.
Yeah.
But I think, again, I hope that will kind of fade. I think that maybe that might be a similar political move.
Okay. Well, great questions. I couldn't get to all of them. I did try to meld some of them together. We now want to do our news quiz. So I need two contenders. Can I have two volunteers? Raise your hands. Have I mentioned the grand prize? Come on. You, sir, come on up. And we need one more person. You have no idea how fun this is. So you just have to.
That's good.
Come on over here. Ma'am. Come on up.
You look so smart. You've intimidated everyone. What's the word?
Why don't you stand here? Oh. Hi. This is like a boxing match. Okay. Okay, and your name is Bob?
Yeah.
And?
Helena.
One of the questions should be, how do you spell Helena?
Well, I can answer that one.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm first going to ask you five questions, and then I'm going to ask you five questions. They're going to be different questions, so got to make it somehow difficult. That was meant to be a joke. It didn't work. If you tie, then we've got some tiebreakers, but usually we haven't had to go to them. So your first question, a zoo in China was caught trying to pass off what? Pass off a dog as what?
I love that.
No, as a lion. Yes. Okay. So what country, this was just big in the news today, what country held the partner of NSA secrets journalist Glenn Greenwald? They held him for 9 hours at the airport on supposedly a terrorist check. Did you see the story?
No, I didn't see the story.
Okay. Let's see, can I give a hint? I can't even think of a hint on that one. Take a guess. This is a country, I'll just say it's very closely allied with the U.S. That was a good one. Want to guess?
Sweden?
No, sorry. It's Great Britain. Okay, you've got three more, don't worry. An Egyptian court announced the impending release of what former leader?
You don't choose this because you don't want to appear so ignorant.
Hosni Mubarak, their former president. Okay, here's a fun one. The CIA made some revelations this week. What did they say, what did they finally admit exists in the Nevada desert?
Testing sites.
Do you know the name of it?
No.
I think I should give that to her, though, because that's what they based right. thought it was. Area 51, which they've said, we're just doing testing there. So, okay, last question. Who said she was denied service in a high-end store in Zurich, Switzerland? Because the clerk didn't recognize her famous face and thought she couldn't afford their products.
See that one?
No? Want to guess? Very famous person. You got it. Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Helena. Well, stay here. Okay, Bob.
I kind of wish I had those questions.
These will be.
Yeah, that's how it's going to play out.
Well, let's build on that one. How much did the handbag cost that Oprah was considering buying?
Like, wasn't it like $1,200 or something. I'm like way low.
Way low. It was a mere $38,000. Yes.
I can't, you know, I just can't.
She's rich enough to have her own America's Cup boat, basically. Okay. Second question. What is the name of the super fast self-powered train revealed this week by Elon Musk? Hint, she said it twice. Okay, it was called the Hyperloop. He unveiled it, but he says he has no plans to develop it because he's busy at the moment. Okay, well, can you name the new mammal that was discovered last week?
Oh, I didn't know there was a new mammal.
It's like a raccoon kind of thing.
That's its exact name. No.
Yeah, no. I can't name it. I know I could see its little cute little face looking at me, and they thought it was a different kind of
animal. Draw a picture of the animal. No, okay.
They thought it was debated for years with a different species that looks similar but is bigger. I know the whole story, but...
It was probably just a dog in a Chinese zoo.
Yeah,
never saw, okay, well, the name of it, I may be mispronouncing it, but it's a new animal, so who cares? Olinguito? Olinguato?
That's exactly right.
We'll just say new mammal. Okay, so how many questions was that? Three, so you have two more chances.
You've got two chances,
yes,
to tie. That's
you've got to get this. Okay, Scotland Yard in the UK is investigating new claims of a conspiracy in the death of whom?
They cannot let this go.
I'm going to take a fall. I know, and say Brian Jones.
No.
Okay.
Close, it was Princess Diana.
Okay.
Rolling Stones. That was good.
Yeah.
Rolling Stones.
Well, Helena has already racked up the win, but let's give you one more question just for...
To salvage my pride.
Yes. What blustery Republican governor told a conservative conference that he has what it takes to be president?
Ooh, blustery. It couldn't be repaired because he's already struck out there. Blustery,
yes.
Republican governor. And it's a he.
It is a he.
So it's ruling out Jan Brewer.
Very definitely.
Yeah, so we can't have her. I'm going to say Chris Christie.
And you got it.
There we go.
Okay, well, thank you both. Helena, you actually won. So here's the mother load. And here's your copies of Mary Nestle's book.
Thank you.
A round of applause for our two winners. Thank you very much. I want to thank our panel, Robin Wilkie, C.W. Nevius, Melissa Griffin. Thank you, everybody, for coming out tonight. It's been really nice having you here. Have a great weekend. Come join us September 10th in Palo Alto.